Over the years, Chrissy Stroup has appeared on this program in connection with her work leading the ex-evangelical movement, encouraging escape from toxic religion, analyzing theocratic impulses undermining our democracy. A full plate for anybody. But Chrissy's recent writing for Religion Dispatches has been particularly timely and incisive, bringing a deep understanding of the themes flowing through our struggling civilization and how they play out in grandiose ways. Dr. Stroop's recent piece, headlined "Stop Trying to Save Jesus: Fundamentalism Reinforces the Problem of Christian Supremacism," compelled us to have her back with us again. It's always good to have you with us. Chrissy, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you so much for the kind words about my work and the article and for extending the invitation, Milton. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
The piece is headlined, "Stop Trying to Save Jesus." Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, I guess the idea came from the sense that I often find myself arguing online with people that I might call toxic fans of Jesus, you know, who just get very, very defensive the minute that you start criticizing anything related to systemic Christian hegemony and the ways that it allows things like Christian nationalism to show up at the Capitol and as a motivating force for the invaders. And the invaders, of course, you know, were just let right through by some of the Capitol police. They also killed some of the Capitol police. You know, there are things that we need to look at, like why are so many evangelical churches in the United States centers of resistance to sensible public health measures, to mask wearing and so forth, and conspiracy theories. And if everyone wants to just come along and say, but okay, but they're not following the teachings of Jesus, I feel like that's kind of a deflection. Mm-hmm. And it's also indicative of maybe an internal debate. But ultimately, when you have these different Christian communities who understand Christian values and teachings in very different ways, I think it's not helpful for the general public to kind of decide, well, okay, those people are the real Christians and those people are not. I think that actually sort of serves to uphold Christian hegemony in our society and to undermine pluralism.
So, Chrissy, who is this Jesus that the Jericho marchers, the Capitol invaders, the self-righteous haters serve?
Well, I'm going to borrow the title of a podcast that I cited in my article, and I would say that Jesus is straight white American Jesus. Mm-hmm. Of course, that Jesus is not the historical Jesus, and that Jesus is not the Jesus of social justice Christians. And yet, that particular Jesus, you know, is an interpretation of him that is very powerful in our society and in many parts of the world. Something like this hyper-masculine Jesus who was recently explored in Kristen Covas-Dumais' brilliant book, Jesus and John Wayne. That's the Jesus that we're looking at here, the kind of Jesus who, you know, maybe we would relate to him more through the book of Revelation or the more sort of apocalyptic passages in Matthew, Jesus with a sword coming out of his mouth to smite his enemies, the Jesus of sort of ultimate divine retribution. And of course, the enemies of God here are defined as Democrats and people who oppose Donald Trump. And then in some cases, even Republicans. I mean, some of these folks were ready to hang Mike Pence because he didn't agree with Trump's bizarre theory that he could somehow wave a magic wand and stop Congress from certifying Joe Biden's victory in the election.
Yeah. Talk about what you mean by fundamentalism.
Sure. Well, I didn't coin the term. A pop culture commentator named Emily Vanderwerf did. And what she means by that is that there are groups of fans in pop culture areas like comic books and TV shows, or we could also talk about books, podcasts, commentators, and so forth, movies. And when we talk about a toxic fandom, which exhibits characteristics of fundamentalism, what is meant by that is that these fans exhibit a kind of religious zealotry, a kind of extremism that starts to look like fundamentalist religion in their defense of what is called in slang their fave, right? Mm-hmm. Or their favorite thing or celebrity or whatever. So, for example, if you want to take the usually the white male fans of the old Ghostbusters movie, the original, or the original Star Wars trilogy, a lot of those folks have reacted very badly to sequels and remakes that center female and non-white characters. They feel like they're somehow losing something there, which doesn't make sense to me, because why can't we just sort of expand and share and everyone can have fun, you know, with the ideas and the universes and the worlds that these movies built. But no, they sort of feel like they're losing something, like it's destroying their childhood nostalgia for the films that they loved if we take those franchises in a different direction that doesn't put straight white male characters at the very center of it. And what Emily kind of posited about them, and I think it's a very astute observation, is that these folks are trying, you know, they're not only just enjoying these movies as a fan, but they're somehow deriving some kind of meaning from them. But obviously this is not a kind of healthy meaning or democratic meaning. And she argues that this is really too much pressure to put on a pop culture phenomenon in the first place. But of course, deriving meaning and helping us navigate our values through that and in community is what it's a primary function of what religion does. And I noticed that in this fandom literature where people write about pop culture, they're often using terms that we use in religious studies like in-group and out-group consciousness to describe how fans behave. And then I thought, what if we flip that script and we take the pop culture analysis lens and we put it on believers and sometimes how they treat the people or divinities that they venerate. And so I started thinking of defensive Christians as Jesus fans, or in the, you know, young people slang, Jesus stands. And then they behave very much like the fans of, say, the old Ghostbusters movie behave, or the fans of atheist podcaster Sam Harris, who has been railing against so-called social justice warriors and has been promoting Charles Murray's sort of new race science and doing some very racist things. Every time you criticize Sam Harris on Twitter, you get a whole bunch of people in your replies telling you that Sam Harris is not racist and Sam Harris is great and why are you so mean to Sam Harris? And the same thing happens with Jesus. And so I thought, well, you know, let's look at that phenomenon. And then let's also maybe ask people to consider, does Jesus, who is supposed to be their savior, really need them to save him? And, you know, I was also thinking about theology, and I think it was, I don't know if he came up with this distinction, but it was through Marcus Borg that I encountered the idea of the historical Jesus versus the Jesus of faith. Mm-hmm. And even if we believe the historical Jesus, you know, was a healer and a radical who was committed to justice for different groups of people, you know, that's still distinct from the Jesus of faith. Mm-hmm. And if you kind of take that one step further, I thought, well, you know, different Christian communities clearly have different Jesuses of faith. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe some are closer to the historical Jesus than others. Certainly, I think so. I find, you know, the kind of Jesus that I see that you believe in, Belton, much more congenial than, you know, straight white American Jesus. And I do mm-hmm. think he's closer to the historical Jesus. Mm-hmm. But if we want to look at the whole phenomenon from the perspectives of religious studies or pop culture studies, we can see that these other Jesuses have a lot of cultural weight and power, and we need to address that and how it can be systemic in a society where, you know, we do have Christian supremacy in the sense that in much of the media it's still very taboo to criticize any large Christian group, and where Christian holidays are still elevated above the holidays of other religions and so forth. You know, there are a lot of ways, and we often don't even really think about it, that Christianity still defines our lives in America. And I think we get distracted from maybe addressing that and talking about how we could be more democratic, more pluralist, by getting sort of bogged down in debates about, well, who is Jesus? Those debates have value among Christians and in theology. But when we look at things from a social or historical or cultural perspective, we see that straight white American Jesus is something that comes out of Christianity and also American culture. But I think you can trace a line back from straight white American Jesus to, you know, Christos Pantocrator, who was, you know, the, sort of the big symbol of the Byzantine Empire, and all the way back to Constantine. There has been this strand in Christianity where Jesus has been used to uphold worldly power. And we might think that the historical Jesus would reject that, and I do, but I also think that in many discussions, that's kind of beside the point. I guess that's what I was trying to get at in that article.
Yeah. Is that part of why serving this kind of Redeemer comes so naturally for these people?
Yeah, I suppose so. I think that, you know, when religion works well and when people become part of a healthy religious community, then it really is about decentering their own desires, right? But the great temptation in a religion is to find ways to use it to justify the fulfillment of your own desires. And the worshipers of straight white American Jesus, well, they want their idealized imaginary 1950s America back, where white Christians were very much on top of the social hierarchy, and that was pretty much unchallenged. Mm-hmm. So when religion goes unhealthy, when religion goes fundamentalist, that's what you have, right? People using religion for their own power, for their own gain. You can say that that runs counter to the message of the historical Jesus, and I think that for the most part it does. But again, their Jesus has been a part of Christianity since at least the 4th century, some version of that Jesus. Mm-hmm.
You know, Chrissy, January the 6th didn't come to be just out of nowhere. Would you describe some of the steps that got us there, especially in terms of Christian nationalist rhetoric and some of the warnings that we should have seen?
Sure, Welton. So with respect to that Christian nationalist rhetoric, I think what a lot of the general public doesn't know is that in Christian schools and often in homeschooling, there are these fundamentalist curricula that are used, put out by companies like Abeka and Bob Jones. And there are some others like ACE, Accelerated Christian Education, or Bill Gothard, some Institute for Basic Life Principles. Well, I guess he's not there anymore because of, you know, the whole sexual harassment scandals and everything. But, you know, a lot of people were raised on IBLP or ACE or Abeka or Bob Jones. And the textbooks, there's actually been some really good studies done that really dug into this and got some data. The Huffington Post in 2017 published a great expose, really backed up by data and serious research, on the kinds of things that Abeka and Bob Jones teach, and on how many schools there might be in the country that not only use those books, but also use public funding from vouchers to teach them. And they came up with the number roughly 2,400. And there are definitely more that don't take voucher funding, but do use those books. And then homeschooling, it's just hard to get the data. Mm-hmm. But there's been a whole generation of people raised by what has become the vast majority of white evangelicals on Christian nationalist rhetoric, where the textbooks teach things like they refer to slavery as black immigration. They talk about how the black Africans in South Africa never would have been able to build a decent society without those white colonizers, and they basically support apartheid. They teach us that Jesus wants us basically to take control of the government to impose Christian values, that, you know, basically everything exists either in rebellion against God as understood by them, or under God's authority, and we need to bring government and everything else under God's authority according to the biblical worldview or the Christian worldview. That's the language that they use. In these schools, children say the pledge to the American flag, and then the Christian flag, and then the Bible every morning. And we saw those Christian flags flying at the Capitol insurrection. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's an interesting point, right? You know, these are the same people who fought to add "under God" to the Pledge of Allegiance in the 1950s, so that was relatively uncontroversial at the time for most Americans because of the Cold War context and wanting to fight godless communism with belief in God. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you then combine that with the pledge to the Christian flag, which ends with Jesus bringing life and liberty, not for all, but for all who believe, you're fusing God and country, and you're really attacking the very concept of pluralism, at least understood as, you know, a situation in which everyone deserves equal accommodation in the public square. These textbooks are often explicitly anti-democratic. They focus a lot on how America was founded as a republic. They teach false ideas. Well, first of all, the distinction between a democracy and a republic is something that they kind of made up because it works for them to try to defend undemocratic sort of situations that we have with, for example, the Electoral College and, mm-hmm. and representation in Congress. You know, they'll talk about mob rule being the alternative, and I think there's, you know, that's not the only alternative. But yeah, they also want to paint all the founding fathers basically as Christians like they are, and that's really a huge distortion of what the founding fathers were really like. I mean, George Washington, you know, he after he was the president and everything, he attended some church services, but he would never take communion because he didn't really believe it. He thought that, you know, maybe a lot of the common people need religion in order to be good, but that, you know, besides the moral message, there's a whole lot of just nonsense that people believe. And that's what Washington thought. You know, Thomas Jefferson was even more kind of explicitly anti-Christian than Washington was, and he, of course, famously made his own Bible by cutting out all the things that he didn't believe and just leaving some of the words of Jesus there that he thought were wise. Mm-hmm. So they distort history like that. And, yeah. and we saw that same version of history in this so-called 1776 report that the Trump administration put out just before Biden's inauguration.
Do you think we as a culture have learned anything of substance from this episode, or are we still too much in the middle, or heaven help us, are we just at the beginning of it?
I fear that we haven't learned enough. I hope that maybe we've started to learn something. But, you know, I do think that January 6th, if we don't take it seriously, could become our beer hall putsch. You know, 1923, Germany, the beginning of the rise of Nazism rather than, you know, the end of something like that, some kind of American fascism. Yeah. We have to hold people accountable for what happened. I don't see that we're really taking steps to do that yet. I mean, a great step and something that could show a sign of good faith from the Republican Party would be if they actually not only allowed the second impeachment of Trump to take place, but they convicted him of incitement to insurrection and barred him from holding public office in the future. But I don't think they'll do that. Mm-hmm. Right now, Republicans in power seem to be trying to just get us to forget that whole January 6th thing ever happened, and certainly not to point fingers at them, even though clearly the connections are there. But when you kick things under the rug like that, they tend to come back and bite you, you know?
A prominent ex-evangelical writer, speaker, and advocate, Chrissy Stroup, is co-editor of the essay anthology Empty the Pews, Stories of Leaving the Church. And we'll link to her article, Stop Trying to Save Jesus, Fundamentalism Reinforces the Problem of Christian Supremacism, from stateofbelief.com. Chrissy, thank you so much for taking time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Anytime, Weldon. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.